Okay, good evening, and welcome to this, the first public events in our series for this academic year. My name is Kevin Featherstone. I'm the director of the Hellenic Observatory, a research unit in the European Institute here at the LSE. And we regularly have a program of seminars, talks, bigger public lectures, etc. So please look at our website, the Hellenic Observatory, and you can get information on the events which are coming up for the rest of the this term. I'll give some announcements at the end of this evening. But let me just mention one thing, that our next event will be on Tuesday the 29th of October, and indeed throughout the academic year, on a Tuesday evening, we plan to have a talk like this every 2 weeks, 6 o'clock on a Tuesday in term time. And on the 29th of October, we're going to have a retrospective on this year's Greek elections, Greek politics after the 2019 elections, future prospects. And we'll have three speakers, the Ioannisis Dimitrakopoulos, who is from Birkbeck College, Maria Karakliumi, who is of the polling company RAS from Athens, and Spiros Kosmidis, who's at the University of Oxford. So we'll be taking a retrospective on the significance of the Greek elections of this year, and then looking forward. So hopefully that will be of interest to you. But as I say, that's the 29th of October, and then we have a number of events thereafter. You can see the sheet which is being distributed outside, but you can look at our website, and indeed you can join our mailing list. So to get things underway for this evening, our first such event, it's a great pleasure to have the opportunity of introducing my very good colleague, Spiros Economides, the Deputy Director of the Hellenic Observatory. Spiros has been at the LSE for a number of years, both man and boy, as it were, student and academic lecturer. Spiros is, as I'm sure many of you already know, an acknowledged expert in a number of areas, but particularly Southeast European politics, the Balkans, and, of course, the topic for this evening, Greek foreign policy. Spiros has held a number of visiting posts in North America, in the UK, and also, of course, in Southeast Europe as well. So he brings much authority to give us an overview. We've invited him to give us an overview in terms of the changes, continuities, challenges of Greek foreign policy. And actually, it's the first time for some years that we've had this as our focus, so it's a great opportunity to look at it this evening. Spiros will speak for 30, 40 minutes, actually for however long he wishes, and then we'll have opportunity for your contributions, questions, comments from the audience. As with all of our events, they're being recorded, and later people can download the audios from the Hellenic Observatory website. But it's a great pleasure to invite Spiros to speak to us this evening.
Kevin, thank you very much. Thank you very much for that very warm welcome, and thank you all very much for coming out on a rainy Tuesday evening in a strange building that you can't find the room to listen to a story about the foreign policy of a very small country in the southeast corner of Europe, which nonetheless I think hopefully is an interesting story, and you may find out a bit more about this more insignificant country and what it's done in terms of its foreign policy. Now, as Kevin said, I have been here for a long time. Just to show you how long I've been here and how long Kevin has been here, I have to tell you that something like 17 or 18 years ago, I presented a paper on Greek foreign policy to this very seminar in a part of the building that no longer exists. So in St. Clement's behind us, which is now that really nice piazza we've got out there, there was a segment of a building which had a seminar room, and I gave a paper on revisiting certain aspects of Greek foreign security policy. And the reason why I entitled my talk today "Revisiting Challenges for Greek Foreign Policy" is because on that particular occasion, almost 20 years ago, the argument I was making is that there are certain fundamental aspects of Greek foreign policy which remain quite static, and they center around four very specific issues. These issues, for those of you who know anything about Greek foreign policy, are pretty obvious. The first issue is the relationship with Turkey and all that surrounds that in terms of the bilateral relationship across the Aegean. The second issue is that of Cyprus. The third issue was that known as the Macedonian name issue. And the fourth and perhaps lesser known issue was the issue of a rather difficult relationship with Albania. And the point I was trying to make on that particular occasion all those years ago was that these are the most important issues which dominate Greek foreign policy, and there's a time to consider a case for closure. How do we go about settling these disputes? What are the prospects of reaching solutions that are equitable and long-lasting? And will the closure of these particular issues really mean a change in terms of Greek foreign policy over a longer period of time? Well, as you can see, these issues are still with us. Only one of them has been resolved in the very recent past, in a very specific way, which I'll come back to later on, and I'm sure you may have questions to ask about the specific issue of North Macedonia, as it's now known, in the question and answer session. But what really struck me in thinking about tonight's presentation is that the other issues, the other three issues, are still outstanding. The point of my talk this evening is not to go into depth about the nature of these issues and what's at stake. Again, we can use these illustrative examples and come back to the discussion. The point of my talk this evening is to suggest that there are two alternative ways of looking at Greek foreign policy over time, in the longue durée, if you want. And that is that the fact that these three issues out of the four still persist would indicate to some that there's something very static about Greek foreign policy and the Greek foreign policy agenda. It's unchanging. In the last, if you want, 40 years, these are the issues, and these are the issues that dominate the headlines, dominate the foreign policy agenda, dominate public discussion about foreign policy in Greece and between Greece and its friends, allies, and rivals. And this is, I suppose, the beginning of my presentation. Is Greek foreign policy static? Is the Greek foreign policy agenda static? And if it is static, what makes it static? So that's the one element of what I'd like to say tonight. To contradict that completely, I'm going to conclude, and I'll show you why I think this, that in fact Greek foreign policy has changed dramatically since the 1980s. And it's changed dramatically for one particular reason, that there's been a significant shift in terms of Greece's major foreign policy umbrella from the United States of America to the European community, the European Union. And this is a significant and deep-seated change which has immense implications for the Greek foreign policy agenda, and I'll try and outline that point in a minute. But let me start with the idea, which is probably the more generally accepted idea, that Greek foreign policy interests are static, the Greek foreign policy agenda remains unchanged. And if we accept this as the main narrative, why is this so? And to accept this narrative, you also have to accept that there's something deterministic about this idea, that there is a framework outside Greece in systemic terms that makes these foreign policy interests static and unchanging. There is something about the nature of the international system, about the structure of the international system, that forces countries like Greece, and in Greece in particular, to behave in certain ways and hang on to very specific issues as the main issues on their foreign policy agenda. And one would start with this kind of interpretation with the proposition that Greece is a small state. And I don't mean that only in geographical terms or in terms of resources, but those of you who study international relations and foreign policy analysis will know there's a specific segment of the literature dating back to the 1970s and 1980s which really tries to understand the role of small states, small powers in the international system. And the reason why they are described and defined as small states is because they have a relative power imbalance in comparison to other states. They are not as powerful as other states. Their resources are limited, their leeway for maneuver is limited, they have to carry out very specific kinds of policies to secure their foreign policy interests. And this is quite reflective of Greece. Greece is a small state. It behaves like a small state. And it's constrained by its status as a small state in terms of its foreign policy. In terms of its security and in terms of securing its external interests, since especially the 1970s, but perhaps even before that, Greece has sought security through alliances, NATO, through cooperation, a variety of different forms and formats, institutionally and otherwise, and through integration, being a member of the European Community and the European Union. Essentially, the worst thing that can happen to Greece in terms of its foreign policy is unilateral action. Unilateral action has tended to end in disaster. The biggest example of this is a historical example which predates any of the discussion that I am outlining today and goes back to 1922 with the expedition to Asia Minor. That's a unilateral action which ended in a massive disaster with immense political consequences domestically as well as internationally. More recently, of course, if you want to put the division of Cyprus into that kind of category, you could explain it away by saying that a particular Greek regime acted in a way which brought a catastrophe in foreign policy terms upon Greece. So unilateralism is a no-go area for a small state like Greece. It has to act multilaterally. It has to act in a particular kind of way, building alliances, engaging cooperatively with other states, and in a very specific iteration of this, operate within the European Community. Greece's foreign policy can only succeed on the basis of interdependence. But keep in mind, again, those of you who know something about international relations theory, interdependence is about mutual dependence, but it's not about symmetrical dependence. It could be completely asymmetrical. So the interdependent connections that Greece has with external actors doesn't necessarily mean it's an equal partner until very recently. And so as a small state, Greece's maneuverability within the international system is limited. And it has to pursue very specific sets of relations to be able to achieve any of its foreign policy goals. That's the nature of the system that conditions it in one very particular way. Structural explanations of the international system of a more pure fashion, if you want, suggest that specific international orders have affected how Greece behaves. Very specific kinds of international orders. I will only pick on two here because these are the most familiar to all of us and they're a very good illustration of the change that can take place and affect how a small state like Greece behaves in terms of its foreign policy. How the external environment conditions behavior and sets a foreign policy or limits a foreign policy agenda. The first and most obvious example is the Cold War bipolar international system. What did this system represent for Greece? From a Greek point of view, how did you view this system? On one level, the Cold War system was fantastic for a country like Greece. It provided security, it was rigid, it was static, and what it engendered was the idea of certainty. You knew where you belonged to the Western alliance, you belonged to the Western world, and nobody questioned your belonging to that Western world as long as you followed certain strict guidelines of behavior. And these strict guidelines of behavior were directly determined by the nature of the system, in which as long as you opposed the Eastern Bloc, as long as you were an anti-communist state, you could exist within very specific parameters, and your interests were guaranteed by this particular system. So, in the Cold War period, Greek interests were guaranteed by the Western alliance, by the United States of America, with exceptions, which I'll come back to. But nonetheless, it provided certainty, it provided an idea of belonging, which may not always have been real, but it was afforded to a country like Greece. The maneuverability within the system was very, very low. And even when individual leaders and personalities in the Cold War period undertook initiatives which strayed beyond what was normal for a Western state, they met with either limited success or were not pursued to their natural conclusion. And I'll give you two varied examples here to show you what I'm getting at. Konstantinos Karamanlis the Elder pursued in the 1970s an attempted opening towards the Eastern Bloc, the Soviet Union, and some of its partners for a number of reasons. There were economic implications for this, there were regional implications for this, and there were implications in terms of the United Nations General Assembly in gaining votes for potential resolution of the Cypriot problem. This was tolerated by the Western Alliance because it didn't deviate too much from the norm, and it didn't raise any existential questions for the Western Alliance. It was simply a way by which one particular country was trying to enhance its capability over specific issues by gaining diplomatic support from others. It wasn't a deviation from the norm necessarily, and it came on the back of general openings from the West towards the East in terms of Ostpolitik, in terms of the thawing of the Cold War between the USA and the USSR, so it was acceptable. The second example is a slightly different example, which comes in the next particular prime ministerial era of Andreas Papandreou, who was considered to be a maverick in Western terms, who for many parts of his tenure as prime minister proposed a very vehement form of anti-Americanism, which was popular among his supporters and among a more general Greek population, but didn't really result in something which deviated from the norm. Greece never left the European community. Greece never left NATO. The protracted negotiations over base rights were protracted, and they resulted in the elimination of certain bases, but the US maintenance of its most important bases in Greece. And Papandreou's flirtation with certain non-aligned type movements really didn't have any significant impact on Greece's location in this particular system. So the Cold War was a structure which limited Greece's maneuverability, and it was a static system, and it allowed Greece very little leeway to maneuver, but when it did maneuver, the consequences were not that great. The next form of international order, which is dramatically different and conditions how Greece behaves, is the post-Cold War period. The end of the Cold War has dramatic implications for Greece as an international actor. Why? Certainty is gone. The system is no longer rigid. The idea that you belong to the West is shattered pretty quickly in the early 1990s because your actions, especially towards neighboring countries, are viewed with a sense of misunderstanding, are perplexing. What is this country doing? Is it behaving like a Western democracy, or is it something else? I remember the cover of The Spectator in the early 1990s, a very important, in a sense, fortnightly magazine in this country, which was trying to explain Greece's behavior over the Macedonian issue in the early 1990s and the big explosion of nationalism which took place, and had a drawing of the Parthenon with barbed wire around it, saying, you know, is this country really a Western country? Is this country really behaving as one would expect of a Western country? Now, I'm not discussing the merits or not of this case. It's simply to explain that in this changing international environment, the nature of the change is extremely problematic for Greece, and it conditions how it behaves. It's forced to do certain things in a period of flux, like, for example, make decisions about its relationship with the neighboring country, which in the long term have a number of negative effects for Greece, and it becomes a perpetuating situation. So here are two examples of how the structure of the international system affects a small state, and in our case, how it affects Greek behavior in terms of foreign policy. The other structural dimension here, which I think has been a perennial in terms of Greek foreign policy, is geopolitics. Geopolitics, for a lot of you who are studying international relations, has been banished from the lexicon. It's not something we've been allowed to discuss since the 1970s as a factor which affects state activeness and behavior on the international stage. It was a taboo word. We don't talk about geopolitics anymore. We talk about transnationalism, we talk about interdependence, we talk about globalization, we talk about a variety of different factors. And yet, in Greek terms, geopolitics has been a constraint. And this is evidenced in the fact that the outstanding issues of Greek foreign policy are neighborhood issues. They are to do with Turkey, they are to do with Cyprus, they have been to do with the Western Balkans in a variety of different forms. These are the issues. Geopolitics matters. Greek foreign policy interests don't stray far beyond the region. There is no sort of broader perspective about what the world should look like, apart from the general adherence to standards that peace is important, liberal democracy should be promoted, human rights should be protected. If there is any instance of Greek foreign policy interests beyond the neighborhood, they are sometimes to do with the diaspora. They are sometimes to do with a human Greek presence way beyond the confines of Southeastern Europe or Europe, which has major implications for the Greek nation. And that is why in the Greek foreign ministry, you normally have an undersecretary of state who is responsible for the diaspora, who has marketing portfolio for relating to that as a foreign policy issue. So that's something quite interesting. Everything is seen through the lens of geopolitics, through the narrow aspect of relations with Turkey, the issue of Cyprus, and relations with the Western Balkans. So the international environment is a constraint. It structures behavior, and Greece has had to operate within this either rigid Cold War international order or rather more dangerous and precarious post-Cold War international order. What other kind of structural limitations are there in Greek foreign policy? Well, I've looked at external ones, but there potentially are some internal ones as well, which really go under-examined in any writing on Greek foreign and security policy. And that is the fact that foreign policy making in Greece is of a very particular sort. Foreign policy making in Greece lacks formal structure, or at least formal structures are very weak. Institutional foreign policy making processes are very weak. The organization of foreign policy is very weak, and the processes are rather haphazard. Essentially, the processes of Greek foreign policy are centered around the office of the Prime Minister. And I'm sitting next to a colleague and friend who, in conjunction with Dimitris Papadimitriou, has written a fantastic book on the importance of the Prime Minister the Prime Minister's office in Greek political life. And that is just as true of foreign policy as it is in other areas of activity and policymaking. And if you do a little empirical work, you will see that the Prime Minister's office dominates historically since especially 1974 in terms of the formulation and pronouncement of foreign policy. I mentioned two, if you want, totemic characters in terms of Greek politics that have been the most important figures on the Greek political scene since the Second World War, essentially, since the Metapolitics, if you want to bring it more up to date, Karamanlis and Papandreou, they dominated the foreign policy agenda. And they dominated the foreign policy agenda, which left very little room for anybody else to make and carry out policy at whatever level within that particular system. It was about personality, and it was about personality from a particular ideological point of view with a specific mission in mind, especially in the case of Karamanlis. Other leaders, in terms of prime ministers, have allowed their foreign ministers a bit more leeway. I'm just looking at the examples of Kostas Simitis, who had a foreign minister in George Papandreou, who was allowed to carry out certain initiatives, especially with respect to Turkey and to a lesser extent Cyprus. But he was allowed to do so because the buck still stopped at the prime minister's office at every step of the way. Our most recent but one prime minister, Alexis Tsipras, had no interest in foreign policy whatsoever and allowed his foreign minister, Nikos Kodzias, to actually carry out a particular foreign policy agenda, which I'll come back to later on. But he himself was a one-man show with a very small number of people around him who conducted this policy. So foreign policy as a decision-making process is very centralized. Parliamentary scrutiny is very weak. Yes, there's a parliamentary committee on foreign policy. Yes, there's a parliamentary committee on security policy, on European policy, but they are very weak. They don't have actually much power of scrutiny. There is a government council for foreign affairs and defense, which doesn't meet. And when it does meet, it makes the front page of the newspapers because, bloody hell, they met. What's going on here? And now that's been abolished as well. It's going to be replaced by something else. And unfortunately, the Greek diplomatic corps and the decision or foreign policy making structures within the Ministry of Foreign Affairs have been significantly downgraded and slightly marginalized. So even the expertise from the public sector is something which has not been maintained and nurtured in terms of foreign policy. Think tanks have been denuded of funds. We have a very close relationship with a lot of us in this room with a think tank called ELIAMEP, which is supposedly the foremost think tank on foreign policy in Greece, that's been starved of funds. It's been starved of funds because governments have wanted to starve it of funds and not make it a viable meeting place for the development of ideas which may contradict the party line, as it were. So there are domestic constraints as well to how and why foreign policy is made and for what purpose. And I think the biggest constraint is not simply the structures and the processes, but the biggest constraint is something which will be familiar to the Greeks in this audience, but perhaps not to others, and it's worth pointing out just for a second. The remaining three Greek foreign policy issues which are outstanding, Turkey, Cyprus, and perhaps other issues in the Western Balkans, Albania plus, are characterized in Greek, as you all well know, as Ethnika Thermata, national issues. What this does, well, firstly, I've struggled over a number of years to try and equate the Ethnika Thermata, these national issues, with some kind of understanding of the national interest, which is used quite commonly in foreign policy terms to explain how and why leaders and decision makers justify their actions on the behalf of the state. In the Greek case, these are not national interests. These are national issues. And what this does is quite often allow leaders, and prime ministers especially, who control the process of foreign policy making, to bypass whatever other structures there are and go directly to public sentiment. And so in a sense, it's the winning out of sentiment over the system. Now, I'm not saying that public views on issues of foreign policy should be neglected or ignored, right? Of course, they matter. But what happens quite often is that nationalism is used to mobilize public support for specific issues, cutting out vast parts of the other decision-making process, which makes this extremely volatile. And it makes it susceptible to capture by a debate which is not really relevant to making decisions in terms of foreign policy. So there's a structural element here which comes from the international external environment, and there's a structural element which comes from within, which conditions Greek foreign policy behavior. What I'd like to suggest is that in the structure agency debate, which Kevin said, asked me earlier on today, you talk about structure and agency. And I thought, well, I'm not really going to talk about structure and agency, but I will talk about structure and agency. Because what I would suggest is that whereby I think the consensus is that a small state like Greece is going to be susceptible to a particular structure in the international system and geopolitics, which will affect its behavior over a long period of time, my argument is that, in fact, in one very specific way, Greece has dramatically altered its foreign policy since 1974, that there's been a significant shift in the foreign policy agenda, and that this shows a degree of agency and change which others may not find applicable to the Greek case. And I'm not referring here simply to the resolution of the bilateral dispute with North Macedonia. What I'm actually referring to here is this biggest, most significant shift from moving from the US umbrella to the European Union umbrella, to the European umbrella. And this is a conscious decision. This is not something that happens by osmosis. This is not something that happens organically. This is not something that happens because others wish it. This is a concerted effort from 1974 onwards by especially Bernard Lees the Elder to find an alternative guarantee to the United States of America, which in some respects could not be trusted constantly to fulfill Greek interests. The turning point, of course, was 1974. The turning point was the division of Cyprus, and the turning point was the fact that the United States of America did not intervene to protect what was seen as Greek interests and allowed a situation to develop, which is still in existence today. And as a result, the pursuit of European Community membership leading to accession in 1981 was just as much about meeting security concerns and foreign policy concerns as it was about the usual narrative of democratic consolidation, economic development, and so on and so forth. If you talk to people, or if you read the memoirs of people who were directly involved in negotiations for EC accession in 1981, you get a picture quite soon and quite clearly that the foreign policy security considerations were just as important as the other ones of democratic consolidation and the economic prospects, the economic gains that we had from joining the European community. The United States of America, of course, still remains extremely relevant in hard security terms and always has done. And you can see even in the last few weeks with the visit of Mike Pompeo to Athens and the signing of a new defense mutual agreement and procurement issues which constantly are on the agenda, the US is still a very important security partner. NATO is still a very important context for Greek security policy, hard defense policy, but the shift has moved dramatically towards Europe. The shift has moved dramatically towards the European Union and the security that the European Union provides for Greek interests in two very specific ways. One is the institutional Europe, and I've written about this before in the context of the relevance of Europe to Greek foreign policy. There's an institutional Europe which makes Greece more powerful. It elevates it out of the small power category. If you have, essentially the European Union is a power multiplier. If you have access to the resources of the European Union in material terms, this gives you extra clout. The potential that the European Union will act as the Union, as you as a member, and impose economic sanctions, divert economic aid, strike a commercial agreement, gives you extra material power to achieve whatever it is you want to achieve. So having access to instruments is important. Being a member of an exclusive club is important. Having a veto in common foreign security policy issues or common security defense policy issues is empowering. So membership of the European Union in institutional terms is empowering. And there are lots of other examples I can give you on this. There's also a different kind of Europe which is also empowering. That's a normative Europe, the Europe of rights, the Europe of democracy, the Europe of prosperity, the Europe of economic development. And you're a member of a particular club that has a very particular mantra, and this mantra has implications abroad, and you are part of that, and you project that as part of your normal foreign policy. So these two Europes have really added to Greece's security and foreign policy capacity, and this has been a fundamental shift of emphasis away from the United States of America to Europe, which has enabled this. This whole debate, in academic terms, is probably best brought together by the literature on Europeanization. Again, some of you in this room may be familiar with the literature on Europeanization. And it's indicative that the very small proportion of the literature on Europeanization of foreign policy, because as Professor Featherstone will tell you, Europeanization is normally discussed in terms of domestic aspects of policymaking, the foreign policy dimension in the literature is significantly larger than one would think. And actually, the studies of Europeanization of Greek foreign policy, a small state, are phenomenally large in proportion. There's been a lot of work on Europeanization of Greek foreign policy, which shows exactly how important Europe has become to Greece and how it has empowered Greece in many respects. The most obvious example being the 1999 change, the volte-face done by the European Union in its relationship with Turkey. This was partly the direct consequence of a Greek government which said, veto? What veto? We're not going to veto Turkish entry to the European Union. We're not going to veto its candidacy. As long as it fulfills certain commitments, and these commitments are good neighborly relations, the resolution of bilateral disputes in the Aegean, and so on and so forth, and you make these conditions of entry, we have no problem. And the European Union adopted this. And these became important parts of the conditionality that the European Union imposed on Turkey as part of its accession process. So this was no longer just Greece, even though I don't think Greece would ever necessarily veto Turkish entry on its own. There were other countries that would have just as readily vetoed Turkish entry. Nonetheless, membership of the European Union changed the nature of the relationship between Greece and Turkey to the extent that it's no longer only a bilateral issue. It remains a bilateral issue, but it's more than that. It's a European issue as well. And this is relevant in the context of refugee flows in 2015, 16, 17, 18, 19, as much as it is of oil exploration rights in the Eastern Mediterranean, as much as it is for a number of other issues which are outstanding in terms of Greek foreign policy. So really, in conclusion, we can describe Greek foreign policy as being the foreign policy of a small power, a small state, which is conditioned by the structure of the international system and has been very static for these reasons. But we can contradict this by saying, in fact, there's been a phenomenally large change, a significant change, in Greek foreign policy, which has been carried out by Greeks who have shown the kind of perspicacity, if you want, to do something about their relative standing in the international system and create a new set of conditions through which they can act and through which they can pursue certain foreign policy goals. Now, of course, this change may have been significant, but the ultimate paradox here is the cases for closure that I discussed 17 or 18 years ago are 75% still there, that we've reached a resolution with a neighboring country over the name issue, which is liked and disliked in equal proportions, but we can discuss the merits of that, as I said before, and yet our relationship with Turkey, the question of Cyprus, and outstanding issues in other parts of the Western Balkans still remain, and we'll see how they change in the near future.
Thank you very much. Excellent, Spiro. Thank you very much indeed. I'm going to invite you to make comments, ask questions, simply say who you are, and we'll take as many as we can. I wonder, though, if I could start with a question of my own. I was very much struck. It's very clear, extremely well-ordered account. I was struck by the contrast between, on the one hand, Greece using the European Union in a strategic sense, the empowerment, and Greece adapting to the European Union in a normative sense. I'm still pondering that. I guess often we think of Greece punching it above its weight, being able to have more, receiving more attention, being able to act in a strategic fashion. But I wonder how far you would think that the biggest challenge or the slowest adaptation has been in the on the normative side, because it strikes me that on a number of issues, this has really caused Greece to self-reflect exactly to what extent we can have a synchronization of European norms and Greek national issues, whatever. So would you say that Greece has adapted strategically much more fully, using the EU effectively, adapted much more fully than it has normatively, where it comes up against domestic public opinion backlashes?
Yeah, quite possibly. I think it's a very fair point, and I think this idea of the normative dimension is far less tangible in the strategic use of the European Union to achieve certain goals. But let me give you one example which perhaps you've thought about, but many people haven't. It would have been unheard of 20 years ago, 30 years ago, for a Greek government to suggest to the population, the electorate, that we are going to deploy Greek troops abroad as part of a multilateral European mission to secure certain European interests in the neighborhood, whether it's in Bosnia or as part of a disarmament mission to Skopje, as it then had to be referred to, or as part of a broader international peacekeeping mission in Albania and so on and so forth. Now, this is an important change, because the only way in which it can be justified is the fact that we are behaving according to certain standards that are European standards. Why is Europe deploying in these areas? It's deploying to provide peace, to provide humanitarian protection for those who need it, to demilitarize, to demine, etc., etc. So, of course, there are Greek interests involved here, as there are Austrian interests or Italian interests, but these are European interests, which reflect some normative concerns. So in that respect, I take your point, but we've had a shift, even in a minimal way, which shows that there is some kind of adaptation there, and it's not simply about securing, about instrumentalizing membership of the EU.
Yes. Great. Let me open up. Bernard.
Just come back to China. I'm interested in the port of Piraeus and the end of the Belt and Road Initiative. You said nothing about Greece's attitude towards China. Can you say, is that part of common policy? Is that part of something else? It certainly looked like you said something about it.
Do you want to collect, or do you want to do it now?
Well, let's collect and
okay. I think that's either you want to.
This is going to be. This sounds ominous. This is going to be dangerous. I know.
So one is, I'm not entirely convinced that there is.
I knew you'd say something like that.
So you know, because what there's a change. So the standard is a shift, even you know, kind of geographical from the U.S., NATO to the EU, without a public. But basically, what you mentioned as national issues, anathema, and the sentimental aspect of that, still persists. And persists even in the 25% of the cases that we did manage to resolve. It was still all framed around that. There was nothing else. There was no long-term strategic interest in geopolitical terms, in economic terms, whatever. So it was still very much that. So I see, in some respects, a lot of continuity. But then can I also sneak in another part of the question and say, you also mentioned earlier that Greek foreign policy, the definition of national issue or of for the policies is always very in the neighborhood, very geographically located. And I wonder whether you think this is a constraint, or you know, to what extent you agree that this is a constraint, that if Greece was able to adopt a more global agenda and have an agenda about China, think about I don't know, Central Asia and other parts of the world, then it would somehow be more able to resolve also its own neighborhood issues. But you know, by over focusing on that, maybe you put yourself on the foot and you cannot actually resolve it.
We'll take another question.
Let me answer those two then, because they're quite big now. Because
yes.
He's sort of collapsed a bunch of issues into two very brief questions. Bernard, your question on China is a very important one, but to a certain extent, I wouldn't consider that to be an issue of foreign policy. To a certain extent. Don't grimace. To a certain extent. Okay? The reason for that is that the port of Piraeus was partly privatized, not because Greece wished to open an avenue of economic cooperation and political, I don't know, whatever, with China, but there was a very significant necessity to carry out the privatization of this port for financial reasons. It wasn't ideological either, right? The privatization was conducted by a government. Now, this is the paradox, Bernard, you know this very clearly. You have a government in Greece, a Syriza government, which is supposedly a very radical left-wing government, which is privatizing national property to a communist regime. You know, the coincidences here are pretty crazy. So it's not, in this particular instance, the port was privatized for very narrow economic interests. Now, the consequences of that may be that there could be further opening towards China for commercial purposes.
Sorry, yes, but there is also the railway, which is supposed to come out.
There are lots of things, but there are lots of things. But what I want to point out to you is that in that particular period when this particular process was set in train, the Greek government also made, that particular Greek government also tried to make openings, not only towards China, but perhaps towards Russia and towards Iran. Oh, where did that lead us? It didn't lead us far down the road of changing the nature of our foreign policy agenda, of making new friends and allies. I think I would reverse your question and say that this is a question of Chinese foreign policy and Chinese commercial policy that's making inroads into Europe in a variety of different ways, and countries like Greece and others in the neighborhood will make the best use of this possible in the short term if there is some commercial gain to be had here. You know, I don't think that Greece's partners and allies view a long-term and substantial Chinese investment in Greece ports, railways, as something which is, you know, necessarily in the interests of the Western world, right? So there are going to be constraints there as well. Vasilis, your question, or your questions are good questions. Let me start with the second one about the constraints imposed by geopolitics. All I was trying to suggest was that a small state like Greece can be conditioned by specific aspects of its external environment, either a very particular kind of international order or because of neighborhood issues. And these are true for Greece. They are true for Greece. It's just that it takes up an inordinate amount of focus on these issues to the detriment of other policies that may or may not exist and may be beneficial in diplomatic and commercial terms. And more importantly, something which I hinted at but perhaps should have developed a lot more, other initiatives that are taken in terms of Greek foreign policy openings to other parts of the world are quite often done for the purpose of resolving these regional issues, gaining support internationally for a resolution of the Cyprus issue which is beneficial to Hellenism or whatever it might be. So that, I'm just saying it's a conditioning factor. I'm not saying, you know, if they didn't exist, what would Greek foreign policy be? It's a moot point. It may be completely different, right? So I can't really answer your question in the way you want me to answer it. Would it be liberating if we didn't have these geopolitical constraints? Well, it might be liberating, but where that would lead, I can't really answer that. Your question about the persistence of the ethnic athemata, I think, is an important one. It's a very important one. And I don't think that's necessarily answerable simply by saying there's been a shift from American tutelage to European tutelage, and that will provide a panacea for all these things, and the answer for all these things. In fact, Greece tried to use the European Union in a variety of different ways to achieve its goals regionally, and it hasn't always worked. In the case of North Macedonia, you could say that as a member state of the European Union, Greece held all the cards, and it could hold out with a very negative policy, if you want, towards its neighboring country from 1991 until 2018, because it was a member of the European Union, and it could convince its partners that it was right, or could say, listen, whatever you try and do, we'll veto it, so stop. This is what we have to do. This is what we'll do. In the case of Cyprus, don't forget, again, Annan plan, Cyprus is going to join the European Union. Well, we can't let Cyprus join the European Union until it resolves the domestic, the divided island issue. Greece says, hang on a second, if you don't let Cyprus join, then I'm going to veto Eastern enlargement en masse, and that's going to cause further problems for the European Union. So bring them in, because this will speed up the process of reconciliation. So it hasn't done so, but it's empowering that you're a member of the European Union. The other outstanding issues with respect to Albania and perhaps Kosovo and Serbia are obviously mediated through the European Union as well. We have strong bilateral relations with a number of regional states, but in the end, what makes us more powerful than them is the fact that we belong to the European Union. Not that we belong to NATO, or that we have a friendly relationship with the United States of America. Our cards are fully marked with the EU stamp, and that's what gives us some kind of leverage, if you want, over our in our relations with them.
Great. Other questions, other comments, please, here.
Hi, my name is Orestes, I'm from Cyprus, the MSc in IR here at MSc. I'd like to draw your attention on the matter that you said earlier. The biggest mistake is probably being unilateral in Greece's foreign policy, and more specifically on the recent matter of the Eurasia interconnector, the electricity connection between Israel, Cyprus, and Greece. Essentially, Greece now has recently sort of decided that it will not participate in this plan, essentially connecting mainland Greece to Cyprus. My question is to this matter is this, given that it's a project of common interest by the EU, and also the fact that they decided to reject this in favor of a Chinese company actually building the connector between Crete and Greece, and also the fact that we've got increasing Turkish aggression in the region, especially against Cyprus, is that sort of an example, perhaps, of moving away from that close EU connection, as you said, or is it an example of a unilateral moment, perhaps?
Yeah, I'll take that. I simply don't know enough about the Eurasian connector, so I'm not going to speak directly towards that, and you know far more than I do, and I'll probably put my foot in my mouth by saying something I shouldn't do. But energy issues, more broadly speaking, in terms of the Eastern Mediterranean, Cyprus, Israel, Egypt, Turkey, Greece, are flavor of the month. A lot of what is going on in terms of the triangular relationship between Cyprus, Greece, and Turkey is discussed in terms of the energy sector, and what a qualitatively different world it would be if we could share the spoils of this energy sector. Or wouldn't it be great if we could just keep, all the resources that are to be found underneath the sea for us and let them starve? So it's become a strategic game. And in the end, we lose sight of the fact that energy is meaningful for commercial purposes, because here it's really part and parcel of a strategic game. You know, whether we have increased and enhanced friendship with Israel, as a Greek state, or whether Turkey, which used to be friendly with Israel, is no longer friendly with Israel. How does Egypt fit into this pattern? It's become a strategic game in which the importance of the actual gas reserves become less and less and less convincing. So every time you open a newspaper, especially a Greek or Cypriot newspaper, even a Turkish newspaper, and you look at what's going on in the Eastern Mediterranean, it is about warships and warplanes and not gas reserves underneath, or oil reserves underneath the seabed. It's become a pretty much a strategic game. Just to add something to that, just last week, there was a Turkish vessel out in the Eastern Mediterranean, the usual drilling which has been going on as a standard practice both by Greece and Turkey for decades now. But it's interesting to note that on this particular occasion, the warships that went out to somehow accompany this and shadowed this vessel were not only just Greek or Cypriot vessels, they were French vessels. So in a sense, this is a form of the European Union taking an interest in the strategic implications of this game that's taking place in the Eastern Mediterranean, which in other terms could be a commercial issue. You know, the Chinese decision, I think, is essentially a commercial one, rather than one which, oh, friendship with China is more important than our friendship with Cyprus or Israel or whoever else may be involved in this game. Please.
Okay. The conclusion of the Helsinki summit in 1999, there was a timeline for Turkey's accession to the EU. There were some conditions that were set. One condition among others was related to the solution of Greece and Turkey bilateral disputes. And in case that these disputes would not have been resolved until December 2004, each member could go to the ICJ in order to resolve, in order to ask for a resolution. Mm. Karamanlis' government did not grab this chance. He said, okay, let's go on. And official negotiations started. Discuss.
Sounds like you were about to answer his essay question.
He's in one of my classes, so I'll ask him. It's a good question. It's a good question, but one again which I'll come back. The realist in me will suggest to you that irrespective of whether these conditions said it has to be resolved by 2004, when Turkey comes down the road, which it won't do in the near future, to coming closer to EU membership, there is one country that holds the possibility of vetoing its membership, irrespective of what may have occurred and what may have been written in the Helsinki Declaration of 1999, and that's Greece, right? Now, whether the Karamanlis government didn't want to do this because it was an oversight, I don't know. The one thing I'm convinced about, is that for a long period of time, from the 1970s onwards, the Greek position on bilateral disputes in the Aegean has been dominated by the idea that we should go to the ICJ, and that these are legal disputes, and the legal world will find in our favor. And I can tell you for a fact that in that particular Karamanlis government, there were a number of people in the foreign policy sector domain close to him who were convinced that if we actually went to the ICJ, the damage would be tremendous. The damage would be tremendous, right? And there are maps, and there are discussions, and there are instances where this could be possible. So perhaps this is why the Karamanlis government didn't take that opportunity. And this is why the Karamanlis government didn't grasp that nettle and say, oh, well, you know, the deadline has passed. The conditions for membership have not been met. What's going to happen? Do we go to the ICJ or not? I think that's the practical answer to your question.
Gentlemen, right in the back.
Hi, my name is Konstantinos, and I'm a PhD student. Thank you for an interesting talk. I have two questions, and you can answer either interesting the shift that you mentioned. I wonder if the public opinion played any role in that, in the shift towards European Union, or you mentioned that the Prime Minister has acted sometimes more dominantly, so maybe even if there was an opinion, that it didn't matter, and whether that changed after the financial crisis, or whether what's the role of that, and the financial crisis.
So what's the role of the financial crisis in what?
In the opinion.
Public opinion.
The other question I had, which is more general, is about the refugee crisis and more generally the immigration issue, and what is the relationship of Greece and European Union there?
Okay. Let's take more, because there were several hands here.
China was mentioned, but mostly...
Do you want to just say who you are?
Yes, my name is Boku Kusanovic. I'm a PhD QT of Spiros, so it was... That's why I didn't introduce myself to Spiros already. So, I mean, China was mentioned in terms of what logic drives bilateral ties between Greece and China, and partially in regards to Europe. But given that the U.S. has become more important strategic security partner for Greece in Eastern Mediterranean in recent years, is there perhaps a fear, because in my humble view, I do think that the U.S.-China rivalry will be the defining feature of the international system in the decades to come. Is there fear perhaps in Greece that at one point they might find themselves pressured by the U.S. on China, particularly since Israel, another partner of Greece in Eastern Mediterranean, has been pressured by U.S. several times whenever there was talk of Greece acquisitioning ports in China, acquisitioning ports in Israel. Is there perhaps that type of fear that they might be caught between in a new type of Cold War stalemate?
Thanks. Let's take about please.
Yes, my name is Alex. I'm a PhD student at the IRA department. My question would be back to the energy issues in the Eastern Mediterranean. You mentioned the French warships that came last week and that they have come in the past. I wonder whether that is a specifically French initiative rather than a European one, because a few months ago we had the Eni drilling being cut off by Turkish warships, and the Italian Navy or the Navy of any other European country did not act. Therefore, to what extent is that a European Union decision or a unilateral French decision to back its companies' interests?
The question about public opinion, I'm not sure I actually understood the second half of that public opinion question, because the first half was about the shift from the US to Europe and to what extent public opinion supported that or was included in some kind of deliberation about that. But how that period from the early 80s links to the financial crisis or more recently, I'm not too sure. So let me answer the first part of that question and leave the second question hanging. Maybe we can come back. Yes, I do think there was a great degree of concern put on public opinion and what public opinion would make of membership of the European community. But as we well know, especially in the late 70s and early 80s, membership of the European community was a panacea. The proportion of the Greek electorate or public opinion that was in favor of membership of the European community was very, very high. And if you link that to the anti-American turn that had taken place amongst the public in Greece as the result of 1967 and 1974, then you can see how these two things come together, that there's an anti-American sentiment, which is ripe, in a sense, for finding alternatives in terms of partnerships and alliances, and a very pro-European sentiment, which is about this path to EU accession and what that can bring, which makes this shift possible in a variety of different ways. Now, how that public sentiment and opinion is shaped and manipulated is very, very important. But membership of the European community in 1981 was very popular. Anti-Americanism was also very high, so the two things fold together quite neatly to produce support for this kind of initiative.
I wonder if I understood the question in the sense of perhaps anti-EU sentiments that may have arisen from the crisis, has it had spillover on foreign policy?
Interestingly, well, I think public opinion has shifted dramatically during the financial crisis for obvious reasons. And the anti-Europeanism which has emerged for the reasons that we all know, primarily austerity, sort of heavy-handed, directoire-type policies, troika, etc., etc. To what extent this has translated in any way to foreign policy issues, I don't think it really has. The one issue that it has impinged upon is the one that you raised in your second question, which is to do with the refugee crisis and immigration, because there you have the coming together of a foreign policy issue and a domestic issue, a national issue and a European issue. And there, I think, it's the one area in which the Greek voter, Greek public opinion, may have a very negative image of the European Union in foreign policy terms, because they haven't done enough to protect us, to protect our borders, let alone our domestic infrastructure in terms of dealing with the problem, where these people want to go and what to do with them, how to process them, how to feed them, how to home them, house them, etc. This, of course, is partly mitigated, though, by the European-Turkish agreement about the flow of refugees, which is now leaking again, but from 2016 onwards was quite rigid. And that was the result of the European Union leaning on Turkey and saying, listen, you've got to stop doing this because the consequences may be great. So, it's a two-sided issue. On the one hand, yes, I think public opinion may have become slightly more anti-European because of the refugee crisis as a foreign policy issue as well as a domestic issue, but the EU's attitude towards Turkey, especially for 2 or 3 years, which managed to somehow stem the flow, may have bolstered that, you know, these Europeans do care about what happens to us and they're doing something to stop this flow. So, you know, it could cut both ways. Vuk, your question about, you know, the future battle is one between the US and China. We've seen this coming for a long time, for the last decade. Some of the people we know in common have been talking about the great next, you know, struggle in terms of international relations between China and the US. Yes, potentially this is the case, and it will be centered on East Asia and not necessarily in Europe. But the Chinese incursion into Europe is something which the United States of America does sit up and listen to. It's one which it has certain concerns over. But as long as they remain, strictly speaking, within some kind of narrow commercial corridor, the United States of America will not necessarily step in. They will not necessarily do anything which is negative in terms of its relationship with Greece. What the United States of America, interestingly, has done in the last few months is try to improve relationship with Greece, especially in the security and defense sector. So yes, it is a concern, but not one which I think can turn sour very, very quickly in the short term. Alexandre, the question of French rather than European initiative with respect to naval warships in the Eastern Mediterranean. You know better than I do that a lot of European security and defense policy, especially at the hard edge, is conducted by very few European states who perhaps are acting on their interests as well as the European interests. So I take your point that there were French interests at stake, or maybe French interests at stake, but then a lot of the military expeditions of the European Union are directed and carried out usually by 2-3 states, and France is always at the forefront. So to what extent it's only a French operation, to what extent it's a French operation under European cover or vice versa, I think it's a moot point.
Other comments, other questions?
Well, I wanted to comment on something more recent. I'm Dimitris, I'm a student of Dr. Economidis. So I want to talk a little bit about the last invasion of Turkey in Syria. And I wanted to ask Dr. Economidis, how do you think the Greek government should act, or what measures should we take considering that they're also allies in NATO? And how could it possibly affect us? Because I think it does affect us, so I just want to hear his opinion.
Yes, I'd like to hear his opinion on that as well.
I wouldn't. I wanted to talk about the size, actually, which was mentioned right at the beginning, whether a small country, as it were, could have an independent, not necessarily independent, or can live through. And in many respects, during the 1990s, after the changes in the Eastern Bloc and the collapse of the Soviet bloc and all the rest of it, what we saw that in the 90s and later on in the first decade of the new century, the new millennium rather, in terms of the outgoing direct investment in the Balkan region and the Black Sea area and all the rest of it, it was precisely, I would put it, the size of Greece as a small nation which was quite important, been accepted there. Obviously, all those countries wanted foreign investment, there is no question about it. But whether it was Serbia or Skopje, as it then was, or nowadays Northern Macedonia, or Bulgaria, or Romania, or whatever it is, accepted the Greek entrepreneurs precisely because they knew that they did not go there to dominate them in the way perhaps that the Japanese or the Chinese or the Germans or the Americans or even the British would have done. The other, of course, issue was the fact that Greece knew that particular area better than anybody else for that matter, and the other countries also knew that area. And talking again in terms of the earlier question of the Skopje issue, let's not forget that we never fought the Skopje those people there despite whatever issues there were. But with the Bulgarians, there were problems until even the Second World War. And of course, nowadays, Bulgaria is a member of the European Union. We have excellent relations and all the rest of it. So the size, in many respects, I would put it, that helped rather than hindered the issues.
Good, thank you. Donna?
I, having just been discussing patriarchs and politics as well, I'm interested in relationships with the Ukraine question and whether positions are being taken there, and if so, who is taking positions, because I'm thinking not only about the role of the church in Greece with respect to what has been going on in Ukraine politics, but also the relationship of the supposed, you know, the ecumenical patriarch who is sitting in the next door country, and the relationships between the patriarchs, the governments of the various countries concerned, Russia, Ukraine, Greece, and Turkey. That seems to be, I mean, that seems to be also, that's foreign policy. I'm not quite sure whether this is complete foreign policy again, because I'm not quite sure where.
It's Byzantine foreign policy. It's Byzantine foreign policy.
Commercial, economic, or, you know, sort of the theological policy begins. And I've never been entirely certain where the lines are. I don't necessarily think there are lines. There are things that are done by other means.
So is the question about the constraints of the church on foreign policy?
Well, does the church constrain it or does it not constrain it? What does the church think relative to what the government thinks, and what does the government think about Ukraine relative to what the church, which is being constrained by somebody outside or inside?
Let me have a go at this, Kevin.
Yes. Syria first.
No, not okay. Syria first. Can I start with the Western Balkans first, because I feel much more comfortable talking about that than the imponderables of Middle East politics and Syria and Kurds and the issues pertaining to Turkish interventions. I take your point about Greek foreign direct investment into the Western Balkans post-1991. Let's not overstate Greek influence in the region. And let's not compare, in a sense, Greek foreign direct investment in the region to what the Austrians have done, or the Norwegians have done, or the Germans have done, etc. Keep in mind that in the period that you're talking about, and I don't have the figures in front of me, but I can share them with you if you want, and perhaps Vasilis can help me, because he's very au fait with these figures. In the 1990s, the GDP, the combined GDP of all the Balkan countries, Turkey aside, was smaller than the GDP of Greece. And I think that's still the case until very, very recently. So if we're looking at Greece as a small economy in relative global terms, being considered to be a regional superpower in economic terms, that's a problem. That's a problem. And let me tell you how problematic it was in the 1990s. Because in the 1990s, you did see a degree of foreign direct investment by Greek enterprises into the countries of the Western Balkans, especially in the financial sector, banking. That was it, really. Beyond that, it was limited. My particular point of view in the 1990s was, okay, foreign direct investment is important, and it's a way of helping Greek GDP, if you want, and helping the Greek economy, and securing certain relations as a neighbor. But the one thing that was lacking here was a concerted effort by Greece in terms of its foreign policy to establish very sound and extensive economic diplomacy. And this was just as true of enabling Greek enterprises to invest, as well as giving direct assistance on a large scale to neighboring countries in one form or another. I'm still convinced until this day that if we'd followed a slightly different route in terms of economic diplomacy and put large emphasis on assisting Greek enterprises in investing in the Western Balkans, and also using a budget which had been allocated and never really used to help the economies of the Western Balkan states in the 1990s, we could have avoided a lot of trouble that came, especially in the context of our relationship with Skopje. We ignored that completely. We went down a different route, and the consequences are that we lasted however long we did without a resolution. There was debate, and this is the degree of arrogance that came into Greek foreign policy. There was a debate in the 1990s about a Greek hinterland. And just the use of those terms, just the use of those terms, implies a sense of a relationship which is completely not only asymmetric, but rather arrogant. That in geopolitical terms, this is our hinterland, and we can do whatever we want. But it was never really carried out in a positive sum way, in a manner that would have benefited both the regional economic development of the Balkans and assisted Greece in resolving some of its foreign policy problems. So FDI is very important, but I think it was mishandled dramatically in terms of Greek foreign policy by successive governments who simply ignored the prospect of using economic diplomacy to achieve certain goals. So that's my particular take on that particular thing. It wasn't even a form of benign regional dominance. It was something between assisting a bit and just letting it go, private domestic. Private enterprises can do what they like, but we're not going to intervene here.
Well, that's a domestic process problem.
It's partly a domestic process problem, but it's also a foreign policy problem. Why not have a very important form of economic diplomacy, which will change the nature of your relationship dramatically by changing the nature of your interlocutor? Mm.
I agree in the sense that there was no government, specific
so we agree
government then. Policy in this respect. It was purely a business enterprise.
And limited, and very limited as well.
I think there was a plan in Simitis government.
It was never materialized. It never came to anything. Okay. Bernard, your question about the church and politics, or religion and politics, or... to what extent the church has any influence in terms of foreign policy. I think the most important thing here is that in the recent past, there was a time in which the church played an important role in certain aspects of Greek foreign policy, whether it was related to our relationship with Serbia, or whether it's related to our relationship with Turkey and the Islamic world, or whether it's relevant to our relationship with Russia, because of competing patriarchies. I think it played some kind of role. In our relationship with Serbia, the church is always raised as this great bond between the two peoples. Vuk, I'm sorry, but I don't think this is the case, and I have a great degree of reticence in accepting that this is an important part of the relationship, only in rhetorical terms. But I think there's something interesting about the Ukrainian case, because there it's about the ecumenical patriarch. There it's about the role that Greece can play in ensuring that the ecumenical patriarchate remains safe and sound and the home of the Greek Orthodox Church. Because what Greek foreign policy in this area of activity is all about is making sure that we don't lose, that Greece doesn't lose that home for the church. Because in historical terms, it's very important. In religious terms, it may be important, but in historical terms, it's very important. That, Constantinople is the home of the Byzantine Greek Orthodox Church, and that where it should remain. And that's why, as you know, some of the conditions pertaining to Turkish accession to the EU are to do with reopening the religious school in Halki, maintaining the patriarchate in Istanbul, and so on and so forth. And that is why I think the Greek foreign policy has been keen to pursue closer relations, or the church has been keen to pursue closer relations with the autochthonous Ukrainian Orthodox Church, because that's a poke in the eye to the Russian church. Not to Russia necessarily, but to the Russian church. It's got nothing to do with Russian intervention in Ukraine. It's to do with the fact that the Russian Orthodox Church has been increasingly seen as a rival to the Greek Orthodox Church. And this is something which the church in Greece dislikes and wants to make sure the government, or any government, stays on the right side of this argument. I'm not sure whether this answers your question. That's as far as I can go.
Actually, the church did not subscribe to what the patriarchate, the ecumenical patriarchate, done. If the Serbians were the first, but everybody else, Cypriots, everybody else would not sign up to this. And if it was,
did it not happen? Did it not happen in the last 48 hours?
Well, this has happened in the last 48
hours. I think it's happened in the last 48 hours that it's been signed, sealed, delivered. But I may be wrong. It's just something that caught my eye.
You want to call? We're waiting for the spirits to tell us.
Oh gosh, Turkey and Syria. I thought I got away with that. I have no idea what the Greek position on Turkey and Syria is, because I don't think the Greek government has got a formal position on Turkey and Syria. I'm sure it does. I haven't heard what the government spokesman has said about Turkey and Syria. Inevitably, this will be dealt with in the context of the European Union. Inevitably, the Greek position will be one which will try and inform the European position and will be done in the context of the European Union. There's no scope here for making unilateral declarations about what's right or wrong about Turkish incursion into Syria. And the European position has been quite strong about what should be done, what's right and what's wrong. And that, I think, is something that Greece will be happy to pursue and support, rather than going down some avenue, because it's Turkey, of saying something more than that. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Only if you ask me.
And I've been waiting all this time to hear about it, and the manipulation of public sentiment for before the election, and all this. I suppose the spectators don't know whether they put people dressed as Alexander the Great in the streets and all that. I felt it was, to say the least, ridiculous. So, but this is my personal view.
Okay. Do we have some more questions? Yeah. I think we are going to run out of time soon, but last questions, comments? Yes.
So I just wanted to pick, my name's Holly Chalcraft. I'm a PhD student at Durham, and I'm doing my research at the moment actually about Greeks in London, so that recent wave of young professionals that's come to the UK. So my question is picking up on what you said about the foreign policy interests beyond the neighbourhood. Like you mentioned the diaspora, but then I also wanted to connect it to my own interests and ask you whether the migration of the young professionals and the diaspora is a foreign policy issue that's maybe growing in significance. I've been following some of the Greek news and seeing about the diaspora vote and then also the brain drain and population issues. So I just wondered if you could share your perspective on this from your foreign policy perspective. That'd be great.
Great, thanks. Last time, opportunity. Any? Yes.
Hi, Elliot Armstrong, PhD student. So this may be a very simple question, but in about 10 years' time, I imagine we'll do another seminar on revisiting challenges. We think Greece will stay aligned with the EU, or will it become more aligned with the US as it once was?
Would you indeed come full circle? whichever order.
Well, let me take the questions in the order that they were asked, and perhaps I'll avoid the last question completely because I haven't brought my crystal ball with me tonight. The question, I'm not sure exactly what it is you want to know, because your question was quite pointed, right? So, do you want my opinion on whether this agreement was
yes,
a decent agreement
or
whether it's a necessary agreement? Okay, so this is where I get into a lot of trouble, right? And I get into a lot of trouble, I get into a lot of trouble because for one specific reason, I think this agreement was timely. And that's because it puts a very specific issue to rest. And it's an issue which has been an open sore in terms of Greek foreign policy, Greek domestic policy, Greek economic policy since 1990-1991.
I knew you would say that.
So why did you ask?
Because...
Now, having said that, there are certain parts of the agreement which are slightly problematic and which are open to interpretation
and which could lead to potential difficulties in the future. But keep in mind, and this is a very important point, that ever since the story started in the early 1990s as an international issue, you have to remember that in terms of the asymmetrical relationship between Greece and its neighboring country, the power disparity is massive, even today, in a variety of different ways. So even though this particular agreement, I'm not saying it's perfect, there are problematic clauses in it that can be interpreted in a variety of different ways, what are you going to do with this? Who's going to manipulate these clauses so it becomes a massive threat to Greek security and foreign policy issues? I cannot see this in the near future, right? So this is my particular take on this. Now, how this came about, for what reasons we reached an agreement in the last year about the name issue is a different story, right? It's a different story. And it's one which I think, in very simple terms, was the initiative of a foreign minister who truly believed that there was a reason to resolve this problem. And on the back of 20 years of negotiation, there were possible solutions that should be explored. There were certain external pressures, but I don't think they were very significant. They were enabling pressures. They were the good offices of the United States of America and the European Union, not pressure exerted on Greece. And this came to a logical conclusion. But it could only be concluded because when this foreign minister went to the prime minister and said, listen, there's a possibility of a deal, and the resulting deal will be the Republic of North Macedonia, the prime minister thought about this as a domestic political issue and thought, if I can put this forward, I will divide the opposition. Because they are nationalists and anti-nationalists and right-wing, and they will be scattered, and this will make my electoral prospects a lot rosier, theoretically, and potentially. And so that's, in a sense, the internal dynamic of what happened for a very important foreign policy decision and how it relates to domestic politics. Now, the other thing that you're asking about is national sentiment manipulation. Well, this has been the case since 1990, right? Yeah, this is ongoing. This is not going to change in the short term, but over time, it'll calm down. I think it'll calm down.
It is the government that has calmed down. That is my
position.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's my take on it, and I don't think there's much more to be said in that particular context. Right. The Greek diaspora, young professionals, young people in general. Well, not necessarily professionals who become professionals, I think is a phenomenon which is unheard of in the recent modern Greek history. I mean, the big waves of Greek immigration are, 19th, beginning of the 20th century, then post-Second World War, and now we've seen this great outbreak. Now, I only have anecdotal evidence, and I don't know what the implications are necessarily for foreign policy. But the question is, what role can a Greek government play in terms of using this Greek diaspora or dealing with this Greek diaspora as a foreign policy issue? Especially in the European context, where it's not really a foreign policy issue at all. It's an internal market issue, it's a freedom of movement issue, it's an issue which is determined by other structural conditions, etc., etc. So I'm not sure how to deal with that. In fact, our colleagues at the University of Oxford, CSOX, have this big program, which I'm sure you're familiar with, the diaspora. They had a recent meeting, I'm sure that's what you're here for, which is something that will tell you a lot more about the relationship between the diaspora, the recent diaspora, and the Greek political scene. But it hasn't really been discussed extensively in foreign policy terms. I just go back to what I said before. It's always been a foreign policy issue. Hence, the diaspora minister is lodged in the foreign ministry. But in the European context, it doesn't always necessarily make sense.
Could I just ask, in relation to the final question, do you think Greek public sentiment towards the United States has been changing despite particular presidents? That if you compare it with post-1974, it's a different climate, more positive, etc. I'm not going as far as the point about US versus EU influence, but Greece has become more pro-American, isn't it?
There is, again, an inherent sort of tension in Greek anti-Americanism. across the ideological spectrum if you keep the sort of edges of the political spectrum out of the picture. Because from the 1950s onward, there's always been a latent anti-Americanism, partly based on the events during the Civil War, partly based on 1967, as I said before, partly based on 1974. But by and large, what you have is a large Greek middle class that is very much in favor of a market-based economic system in which we can share in the riches of laissez-faire, an American dream, if you want, of what the economic model should look like. Welfare provision is much more important than it would be in the American model. But there's an anti-Americanism which doesn't jive very well with a great sort of capitalist urge, if you want. Right? And I've never fully understood this tension, or I haven't really examined it, but it's always been there. It's always been there. Anti-Americanism in conjunction with a very consumerist society. A society which is very interested in what the market provides and how it can benefit from the market. And a very entrepreneurial society in many respects. So what is this anti-Americanism about? Is it really to do with specific events? Or is it something to do with an underlying tension there which only manifests itself occasionally? And I think this is what we need, this is the context we need to put it into, that there may be a turn towards the United States of America in terms of public opinion. I don't know, I haven't seen any polls on this, but that turn may be having to do with the fact that the Americans have come out and said something pro-Greek with respect to the relationship between Greece and Turkey. Oh yes, these are our great allies and friends, they said something about the relationship with Turkey, they'll come to our defense. Wow, anti-Americanism goes down. Yeah. And I think there is a factor of that. As long as they support our interests, they're our friends. If their interests has to be shared amongst certain friends, they're not our friends anymore, so we have to find something else to bash them over the head with.
Well, thank you. We've come to the end of the session, and I'm sure, like me, you're very appreciative that Spiros has covered a very broad terrain with a number of very, very good insights. So I think this has been a masterly picture of the topic of foreign policy. Before I ask you to thank Spiros, just a reminder that our next session is on the 29th of October. We're going to be looking at the elections of this year, the prospects for the party system for Greek politics, etc. And we have a panel, and that will be in the Wolfson Theatre, 29th of October at 6:30. But can you please join me in thanking our speakers?